I'm literally sitting overlooking the Royal Mile with Mark Fisher and Neil Cooper. Mark is a freelance journalist whose new book has just been published. I think it's called How to Write About Theatre, but I don't want to get the title wrong.
That's correct.
Congratulations, wonderful book. And Neil is the journalist from The Herald.
Yeah.
Right, we're going to pick three major productions, or possibly four actually, that we want to talk about, and then we're also going to pick a few favourites just to give you a real feel for Edinburgh 2015. So the International Festival is now coinciding with the Fringe, and Fergus Linehan has got off to a storming start. We're all waiting to see Lanark tonight, which hopefully will cap a great year. But Mark, do you want to tell us a little bit about the successes so far?
Yes, one of the interesting phenomena in this year about this year's festival is that ticket sales across the Fringe and the International Festival are hugely up. I was talking to someone the other day who said that it was like 30% up even, and I've certainly heard 15%. Officially quoted, and I think part of the reason for that, you can only speculate, but one of the reasons I think is that the dates of the International Festival and the Fringe are coinciding. But I think more importantly than that, the two shows we're just going to talk about now, 887 by Robert Lepage and The Encounter by Simon McBurney for Complicity, both have long runs. They have two long in festival, international festival terms. They're running for, both of them running for 2 weeks, and I wonder whether that's because they are such big names, I wonder whether that has influenced people to say, right, I could come to Edinburgh at any one of those times. I'm not going to miss either of these shows, and then I can stay and see other shows in the Fringe at the same time. That's just my theory, but I think even if my theory is wrong, the fact of having these two major names of world theatre doing what I believe, and many people believe it to be fantastic shows, really does mean that there's that sort of rootedness of as it should be of the International Festival saying, right, this is the benchmark of quality, and then you've got all the Fringe stuff around not necessarily worse quality, but kind of there's a bar that's been set. So both of them, interestingly, both 887 and The Encounter begin almost exactly the same way. They both begin with they're both one man shows. They both begin with the respective performers coming on stage and saying, oh, look, I've got an iPhone. Isn't it interesting how all our memories go into our iPhones these days? And then they take them off in very, very different ways. But I suppose both of them are thinking about ideas of communication, and Lepage thinking about memory. And in 887, it's the show. 887 is the apartment that he grew up in Quebec City, 887 Avenue Murray. And he uses the his childhood as a way of looking at the past and looking at the way that we tell stories about the past, but not just his own past in the 1960s when there was a sort of insurgence of Quebecois independence. The FLQ in Quebec was very active at the time with the bombing campaign to with a view to the separation of Quebec from the rest of Canada, but he also goes further back in time to the time when France and Britain were arguing over the future of Canada. So there are all sorts of memories, but and being Lepage, it's technically dazzling with actually using this iPhone as a camera to project these little puppets and very small scale figures that he has on stage, which then become blown up, and it's almost like his memories are. It's like he's bigger than his memories, but his memories are then projected bigger than him. There's some interesting thing about scale there. I could talk forever about that show.
There's something there is a point where he's in front of the model of the apartment block, and you see it. And it's almost like he's playing God with his own past in a way.
It's like.
And it's a lovely, lovely thing. And it's like, I mean, I don't have as much of a relationship with Robert Parrish's work as Mark does, but, you know, and at times when I've seen it, you think that the technology can overburden everything else that's going on, but it certainly wasn't the case here. And I mean, because he came a cropper 20 years ago when he was last tried to come to Edinburgh Festival, but there was technical hitches and the seven streams of, and it was at Elsinore, and it had to be cancelled. But here, it's just absolutely exquisite the way technology is used, and it's there to serve the story. Maybe it always is. You say, you know his work far better than I do, but I mean that and Simon McBurney's The Encounter, they are very, very similar in that they're very personal but very political as well. They you know, that it does come from a very personal root. You know, Simon Burney's the Encounter is drawn from a true story about a National Geographic photographer who went up the Amazon and ended up with this tribe, who is an undiscovered tribe at the time, who had been basically pillaged by and colonized, but attempted colonization by white people, and they chose to reinvent their own past, and in a way, that's what Simon Burney is doing, and going to his own world in that way. So both very similar.
He also creates incredible technical excitement, Simon. Mm-hmm. And Mark, why don't you? Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking because the parallel again with technology that Neil is talking about with Lepage is it also exists with the McBurney. That one of the crucial things, interesting points about this true story in the Amazon is that the photographer had no shared language with the tribe, but suddenly realised he was fine. He knew stuff that he couldn't possibly have known, and he just described it as sort of an extrasensory perception, or beaming. And he was having these conversations with the elder of the tribe, and McBurney uses that idea as the sort of basis of saying, well, how can I express to the audience the idea of hearing voices? Mm. And he uses that technologically by creating these surround sound effects. So we're all sitting there with headphones on, and the level of invention over this 2-hour show just with sound effects is, I think, quite astonishing, because it's because he runs with that idea. So it's not just the idea of ESP or whatever, it's the whole the whole way that our senses are determined by these sounds, the sounds of the jungle, the sounds of the past, the sounds of communication.
And occasional rude intrusions from sounds of his own kids.
And
that's really sweet. You know, that was actually, you know, it was funny because I interviewed McBurney, and his wife had had a baby the week before, and then so he was trying to take his while we were talking, he was trying to take his wife a cup of tea in bed, and then and then his kids kept interrupting and asking him things, and I saw it was like, so when I saw the play, it was like,
and the amazing thing is that having programmed these two, I'll call them solo shows, there are an awful lot of people behind the scenes.
Yes.
They complement each other, because you could very easily have had pretty much the same thing happening twice and think, why on earth has he programmed these two shows that are almost identical, just from different places? And it doesn't feel like that at all.
Well, no, I know, yeah, because on paper, if they had been existing shows, on paper, you would go, oh, no, we can't have that, because, but, you know, they both do radically different things, in radically different directions. But something that Fergus Lennon, the new Edinburgh International Festival director, has done this year, you know, that, as you said then, you know, raise the bar, it's a far starrier. I use that word "starry" in inverted commas, because, you know, they're obviously still quite niche, but in theatre circles, they are stars, and that in itself is making the statements in the way that previous directors haven't really done for a long time.
Not
occasionally,
long time,
but not you know, not that. It's like, okay, there's something to grab hold of there. If you're not maybe a regular theatre audience, you will maybe know Lepage. I mean, what we need to get back to now is the old days when Channel 4 or the BBC could broadcast these things in full as well. And, you know, but, you know, that was when Michael Cousteau was running the arts department in Channel 4 and could do that sort of thing. And there's no will now, because it appears to be run by 12-year-old idiots. But it's...
but, well, let's hope one of the 12-year-old idiots becomes a 13-year-old idiot, matures enough to commission something, because it would be wonderful, definitely. The solo show, I think, has been one of the themes of Edinburgh 2015. I must have seen the majority of the 80 odd shows I've seen have been solo.
It's very interesting, because people were saying exactly the same thing in 1986. Oh, there's so many solos, so many solo shows. Is this a sea change? And it's like, so things in a way have possibly come full circle. But I do know what you mean. And you know the fact that, I mean, the show maybe talked about later, Man to Man, which was first done at the Traverse in 1987 with Tilda Swinton. That. It kind of marks that sea change in a way. And one thing I have noticed as well is the power, or the strength of Female actresses this year, both in solo shows and ensemble things.
That's the leading I wanted. That's really kind, Neil. So another I was going to say show. It isn't a show, and it's not a single play. It's a trilogy of plays, all played by Maureen Beattie. They're Canadian plays. They go under the title of the Jennifer Tremblay trilogy, and they could not contrast more in many ways with the two that we've discussed. Because this is low budget, though John Byrne has done the design, the playwright, TV maker, and it looks beautiful. It's a single actress on a stage, no support at all. Wonderful direction from Muriel Remains, I should say. Support at all. There's no massive technical team behind the scenes. And it's one woman telling three really touching, poignant stories. She's called The Woman, which is a good, nice name for her.
And it's Maureen Beattie, the name of the...
Yes.
And I hope I mentioned Maureen Beattie. And her acting is just outstanding. She certainly should be winning or up for awards for it. And there are stories set in Canada, but delivered with a Scottish accent, which kind of gives it a dual nationality in a way. And it does work in both contexts. And there's a story about a potentially paedophile father-grandfather. There's a story about a lovely neighbour called Caroline who is terminally ill with lots of children. And there's a third story, the one I saw most recently, The Deliverance, and I'll remember what that one's about eventually, but I haven't been sleeping much lately.
The stories are sort of the same character going from one to the other, and I haven't seen them all together, there's a disjuncture between them, but it's her reuniting. It's about her mother, who is on her deathbed to be reunited with the son, and so she doesn't want to do it.
And it's kind of closure. This woman's journey from basically going out to the country to find herself again, and then external events intrude on that. That's in the list, the first play. Then in The Carousel, it moves into more personal territory with the mother, and it's more a direct link, really, with The Deliverance that follows it, which is all set in a church, and is a kind of purging. In a way, in a secular way, but it's interesting you saying it's a Quebecois play, but done in a Scots accent. There's always been this remarkable relationship between Quebec theatre and Scottish theatre for a long time now. And Stella Quine's the company run by Muriel Romanus, who did the Tremblay trilogy, have been part of that. They're major players in that. I mean, there's something. There's something about Quebecois theatre, and Lepage is part of it as well. I've always had this kind of theory, really based on not terribly much, but there's a kind of emotional nakedness there to Quebecois drama, which, I don't know where it comes from, whether it's something inherent in the culture or what, but, it's always there, and it's certainly there. And Maureen Beattie's performance as the woman, it's really raw, it's really out there. I mean, she's a remarkable actress anyway. She's been in lots and lots of things, but this is just like, wow.
And it's also helped a lot. I mean, the simple design, the really effective lighting, and an actress on the top of her form retelling beautiful stories.
And actually, that shouldn't be understated, because on The Fringe, the pressure of fast turnaround times and so on, it's really quite rare to see as lighting as beautiful as Janine Byrne's lighting and John Byrne's set is really kind of strikingly good.
It possibly helped them at one point, so they did do all three on one day, but I think otherwise they have been dotting in and out.
There's a real care to it, I think, and I don't know whether that's because they've been working on and off on these three plays for such a long period, but there's a real sense of care, which is really rather lovely.
Right, then, to go from the sublime to the equally sublime but ridiculous, Neil, do you want to tell us about the highlight of the Travis this year?
Yes.
the
highlight for me of the Fringe so far, I mean, we've got another week to go, who knows, but it's Our Ladies of Perpetual Succour, which is presented by the National Theatre of Scotland and Live Theatre Newcastle. And it's an adaptation of a novel by Alan Warner, Scottish novelist, of his book The Sopranos, which is a novel that came out in 1998. And it's about a teenage schoolgirl choir from a kind of mythologised Oban on the west coast of Scotland, who come down to a big city, which may or may not be Edinburgh, to take part in a choir competition, and they basically go out on the lash, and it's all about these kind of crazy hormonal girls just grabbing hold of life, and there's tragedy afoot in it. There's six of them, and this adaptation is by Lee Hall, who wrote Billy Elliot, and what he's done with Vicky Featherston, the former director of the National Theatre of Scotland, who initiated this project when she was still there. She's still now at the Royal Court. They've turned it into a kind of almost like a gig. It's set in this horrible dive bar called the Mantrap in Oban, the trappings of it. And they go through, all the six actresses play all the parts, they play all the ridiculous men that they encounter along their kind of life in a day, but there's kind of, I think, about 13 or 14 songs, choir songs, as well as more contemporary pop songs. There's Electric Light Orchestra, and even the Brookside theme, but all of that, it's hilarious. It's got some of the most creative swearing I've ever heard. And you know, it's a really creative adaptation, but it's also really, really poignant and really sad about that moment in a teenage girl's life when they're on the cusp of something. There's tragedy, you know, one of them's not well, and you know, and all these things going on. There's the sexual awakening. There's all of this, and it's beautiful. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing in terms of empowering young women and the characters, and played by an amazing set of actresses who are just incredible.
It's a fantastic ensemble, isn't there? And yeah. I think one of the things about the serious aspect of it, which is it's kind of there without being kind of laboured, but it's the book and this adaptation are so much about how their family and social backgrounds are influencing their lives, and you don't know what's going to happen in their lives in the future, but their particular upbringing, whether they, you know, there's one middle class girl, but there's another girl, you know, who's had family problems, all the rest of it, that, you know, the future story is sort of embedded in their characters today.
Yeah.
And the other thing I think that came to mind when I was watching it was remembering when the first time Irvine Welsh was adapted for the stage, so when Trainspotting was first adapted, which was just before the movie came out, and suddenly you just heard, it was like you were hearing a vigorous voice in Scottish theatre for the first time, because this stuff, this language was fantastic on the page, becomes even more beautiful and vibrant and rugged and all the rest of it when it's spoken. And, and hearing Alan Warner's dialogue, it becomes a very, I mean, Lee Hall has done a fantastic adaptation, but a lot of it is taken straight off the page.
Yeah, well, it's all there. It's this kind of baroque swearing. It's really flamboyant, but really, really rooted in where they're from. But it's interesting you mentioned, you know, because Trainspotting went on to, you know, turn the world upside down and all the rest, because The Sopranos, which obviously couldn't be called The Sopranos for a certain TV show that came out a year after the novel, that was being developed as a movie for a long time by Michael Caton Jones, and it still hasn't happened. Whether it does or not, I don't know. But Alan Warner told me that basically Michael Caton Jones suggested this idea of having a kind of meta-ness where they're using the live music, where they step out of character. And it's like, you know, Warner said to me that, you know, basically Michael invented Glee before Glee happened. Because that's kind of how it is. Mm-hmm. And it's like Glee. And, you know, you've got choirs on the telly all the time now. You've got the X Factor. But in terms of the effect it's going to have, it'll be, I suspect it's going to have a huge amount of longevity. It's got an autumn tour already, which I know is almost sold out, because two nights in Musselburgh, which I've been telling people to get tickets for, and the tickets are almost gone there. And it's almost like a girl band Blackwatch in terms of the effect that it's going to have, I think. Well, and I think it will go global.
That's quoting from my review, thank you. I appreciate it.
I haven't got time to read.
Just to give a slightly different take on it, the way I was looking at it was, in theatrical terms, it's more like a cross between The Commitments and Once a Catholic, except set in Scotland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's Yeah, we've been talking seriously about this, and it is serious, but boy, is it fun.
Yeah.
Anyone can go along, and they will enjoy themselves. Yeah, yeah, they'll have a lovely time. As Neil has suggested, if you don't like swearing, then you may find it a bit over the top. But other than that, just go and see it. It's fantastic.
And the other thing about this, the nature of adaptation, because, you know, you can enjoy a book, and, I, you know, The Sopranos is a very, very entertaining book and relatively, you know, quite easy read. It's fun and so on. But when you put something on the stage, when you put this one on the stage, there are jokes that appear that you are hard to imagine when you're reading. So, and the crucial one being, you've got these six girls who right at the start are singing this beautiful choral music, and then, all, as Neil says, all this swearing and life comes out of them, and there's a sort of implicit joke that these people who can make this beautiful sound are actually as, you know, scabrous and foul-mouthed as you could be.
I think we could talk about this for the next 2 or 3 hours, but what we probably ought to do is let you get away and try and book tickets before they run out.
Yeah,
I think they may have done already.
Yeah.
And if you don't catch it in Edinburgh or around Scotland, we're all suspecting this will be going across the UK, across the globe very soon, so don't miss out. Now, just to finish off, a couple of tips from each of us for other shows that may be a little bit less well known that we think people might want to go and try. Neil?
Well, I mean, I mentioned it earlier, Man to Man, which is a play by German playwright Manfred Karg, which was first done in Edinburgh in 1987, famously with Tilda Swinton in the role of a woman who takes on, initially in pre-war Germany, or takes on the identity of her crane driver husband, and including his job, she basically pretends to be a man, and through that disguise we see her moving through German history, through the war, through the wall going up, and crucially here through the wall, the Berlin Wall coming down, because when the wall came down, Karg wrote an extra scene for it, which I think it's been done a couple of times before, but it's a beautiful production by Wales Millennium Centre, who are that's interesting in itself, them becoming a producing body, and it's directed by Bruce Guthrie with Stephen Hoggart from Frantic Assembly. Beautiful performance by Margaret Ann Bain as the woman, and again, it's an astonishing female turn on stage. It's really powerful and a real insight into about how lives had to be reinvented in the face of adversity. In that, it's beautiful.
And what else has really appealed to you?
Let me think. Oh, I managed to get a ticket for Daniel Kitson's new thing.
Oh, did you?
Polyphony, which is really interesting. It's very Daniel Kitson, if that, you know, which, you know, he
Daniel
says
Kitson
that himself.
Tends to be very Daniel Kitson.
Yeah. And it's what it is. He starts off, it's in the Payne's Plows, what do you call it? It's not speed.
Roundabout.
So it's in the round. And he, you go in and there's this little circle of iPods attached to speakers, and it looks like a mini Stonehenge, sort of a little bit Spinal Tap. And he starts talking and he starts handing these out one by one, but they're set in such a way that voices will come out from each of them. And like, so you've got, you know, asking him questions. So he said, what's this play about? And it's like, well, we're coming to that. What I'm going to do? And then all these voices, kind of dissenting voices about that. And it becomes about, he never gets to the play, because there's all these interjections from these 12 or 16, I can't remember which, iPods. But what you get is sort of this chorus of disapproval, if you like, and approval of his work. You know, there's one of the voices is a fanboy, one of them is just telling him to get on with it, and, like, you know, and this sort of thing. And it's kind of a meditation on his own work, and, you know, very Daniel Kitson in the sense that he does contemplate his own work in practice, and that's becoming so it's a big fat in joke, but it's amazingly done, just in terms of construction and the way he interacts with the iPods and the way he does.
Mark?
I was just going to just to remind myself and remind the world of the peculiar places that you can end up with in on the Edinburgh Fringe, just because of because of the pressure of space, partly because of the creativity of performers, and two shows, actually neither of which are a theatre, which I ended up seeing, include there is a bus, Bob Slayer has a bus called Bob's Blunderbus, which is a double-decker London bus that you'll have walked past en route to the George Square area. And I ended up seeing Phil Kay there. So he's taken out the seats at the top deck of the bus and replaced them with actually rather uncomfortable seating. And I saw Phil Kay, comedian, do a fantastic comedy set there. You know, with virtually, you know, you've got the performer virtually right in your face because the space is such that there isn't much space. And you know, this is a bus that you sometimes see around town that Bob Slayer will be driving around shouting out of the window. And then another show I saw was in a squash court in Stockbridge, and a rather lovely dance show called Squash Squared, involving two dancers who use the imagery and movement of the game of squash and sort of make it abstract. And there's a line about the collegiateness and competitiveness of dance, of squash. So the game of squash involves two people playing, and the fact that they both go together means that they're on the same, technically doing the same game, but they're also very, very competitive, and they arrive with their suitcases and go onto the briefcases, and so it's as if they're sort of two businessmen who then throw themselves into this very vigorous game. So that was a little treat to see.
My two diverse experiences. One is the bite-sized breakfast. I love the bite-sized breakfast plays. These are five or six little plays done at 10:30 in the morning in Pleasant Stone. And the quality is almost always, I'm beginning to wonder whether they're pseudonymous, because some of the playwriting just seems far too professional to always be by people I've never heard of. And the programme one this year was just really exceptional. There's a super little love story that could develop into a full-length play very easily. There are little skits, little this, that and everything. And I urge anyone who can get up in time for 10:30 to go and give them a try. Secondly, so almost the same venue, just literally upstairs from there, Spillikin, which I hadn't heard of at all, and I was asked to go and see it. And this is a play about young love and old age simultaneously. So, and there's a fantastic robot, and it sounds stupid. This robot is state of the art. I suspect it's come from some kind of university research lab. And the robot replaces the young man when he becomes old. The old woman has dementia that's getting worse and worse, so by the end of the play she's almost completely incoherent, and the robot has been programmed with her late husband's memory to kind of support her, and it's very beautiful on that level. And then there are flashbacks 50 years to when the two met as school children, and he was a geeky nerd, surprisingly, the robot man, and she was a bit of a wild child who, not quite from Our Lady's Perpetual Succor, but she could have sort of come into the second division or the second team there, I should think. It's just it's horrible to say a sweet play, because it's far more than that, but it is very, very good, well-made play, which is nice to see in Edinburgh, because it's unusual, and it's got more than one person in it.
That's a novelty.
Exactly. Thank you so much. I think that should have given people a very good idea of what's on in Edinburgh at the moment. Very strong year at the very top level, which is great news. Thank you.